You're listening to Writers on Writing, a show about the art, craft, and business of writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest today is Grant Faulkner, the former executive director of National Novel Writing Month, the co-founder of 100 Word Story, and the co-host of the podcast Right Minded. His essays on creativity have been published in the New York Times, Poets and Writers, Literary Hub, Writer's Digest, and The Writer. And his stories have appeared in the Southwest Review and the Gettysburg Review, and he's been anthologized in collections such as Norton's New Micro, Flash Fiction America, Best Small Fictions, and Best Microfiction. He's here to talk about his new book, The Art of Brevity, published by the University of New Mexico Press. On the show, we talked about why writing good flash fiction is especially difficult to get right, the role of dialogue in flash, what you want to leave a reader with at the end of a story, how writing flash fiction influences his longer prose, the most common mistake he encounters in flash, and more. And now for my talk with Grant Faulkner. So Grant, I'm so happy to talk with you. I became familiar with you with Right Minded.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And then, of course, NaNoWriMo, you were the executive director for a number of years.
12 years. Yeah.
12 years.
Yeah.
And so it's a pleasure to talk with you. But before we talk about the art of brevity, I'd love to hear how you found your way to writing and then to flash fiction.
You know, it's so interesting to me because I don't remember a time in my life where I didn't think of myself as a writer. My earliest memory, I think I was like 3 or 4 years old, and I remember getting this idea for a book series, and I remember running down the stairs, you know, eagerly to tell my mother about it. And this is in back in the day, pre-Facebook, pre-internet. And of course, the main way for my mom to connect with her friends was on the phone. And so she would have these long conversations that seemed endless to me as a child. So she was talking to a friend, and I ended up not telling her the idea because I couldn't wait any longer. But that's my first moment where I, you know, really thought of myself as a writer. And my mom, just to give her a little better reputation to the public, she bought me this wonderful old, she was an antique collector, and so she gave me this old oak roll top desk that was perfectly sized for like a 6 year old, which is when I think she gave it to me, around then, 5, 6, or 7. And also for my birthday around that time, I coveted this bound journal, looked like leather, in our local bookstore, and it had a little lock on it. And so, between that journal and the desk, I was off. Yeah.
What a great mom.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice to, you know, I mean, that's one of the tough things about being a writer is that we hear so many voices of discouragement. So, you know, that's just, it's kind of a minefield, right? You'll eventually be discouraged. I mean, that's just guaranteed. So, you know, I think we have to gather up all the support we can, and especially parental support is like super important, really, at any stage of a writer's life, but especially in those early stages.
So was it always fiction? Were you always writing fiction?
You know, I pretty much was always drawn to fiction. Yeah, I also always felt myself as a fiction writer. And of course, I went down numerous paths. I mean, my other classic kind of inflection point was when I was in college and I was deciding whether to be an econ major or an English major. and very fortunately, I went for a semester abroad in France and spent the whole time reading novels in cafes and writing. And I just thought that was clearly the life for me. And it's wonderful that I didn't try to be an econ major because I just would have failed miserably. I didn't ever look back or ever question it as an endeavor after that. I mean, I, of course, did struggle to make ends meet. So I entertained different jobs, but they never strayed too far from being a writer.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And what did you read as a kid?
What did I read? I don't know. You know, I actually, that's the funny thing is, I mean, I did read fiction, but I didn't read predominantly fiction. I was really into the presidents. So I read all these presidential biographies. I was really into sports. So I read all these books about sports. I just, the wonderful thing about being a kid is I just remember kind of picking up books because the cover looked interesting, like my sense of curiosity. There was no agenda to it, right? I mean, my reading was all for pleasure and satisfaction. And it is that today too, but I also have an agenda at work. There's certain books I want to read for certain reasons. And so I sometimes miss that sort of really spacious world where it's only my curiosity and I only want to read books, that satisfy that. Yeah.
And then flash fiction. How did that happen?
Flash fiction was interesting. I always loved writing short stories, but, I think like most writers, at least of my era, there was a kind of conventional short story form that was somewhere between like 5 and 10,000 words. And that's what most of the literary journals published. And so and when you get your MFA, that's what the focus is on, is that kind of genre of short story. So I was really focused on that. And then, a lot of us, like the short story is kind of a training ground or the minor leagues before you hit the major leagues of novel writing. And so for years, I was interested in writing novels. And somewhere in there, I was working on this novel that I call my doomed novel. And I'd been working on it for 10 years off and on. And every time I went to revise it, I was like, this is the time. This is the time I'm going to nail it. I've got the perfect vision for it. And it was always lacking a little bit. And so I was frustrated with that. And one night, I saw that my good friend Jake Strom from college, his father Paul Strom, who was kind of a mentor of mine, an unofficial mentor, he wouldn't know or identify himself that way, but he had published a memoir that was 100 100-word stories, and 11 of them or 9 of them were in the magazine 11/11, and I read them and I was just enchanted by them, entranced. I just had never, I never really considered this tiny fictional form. And I started experimenting with it and trying to write my own. And I found that I could only get them to be about 150 words. That's as short as I could get them. And I told Paul that, and he said, no, you have to get them to exactly 100 words and the story will improve once you do that. And he was right. It took discipline. It took kind of training. It took kind of reconfiguring my mind around a different kind of storytelling. But by writing them, and it's not like 100 is a magical number, right? It's like they could have been 99. They could have been 101 words or 107 words. But it's all about that creativity within a constraint. And that really like rigid constraint brings out like a different type of creativity and kind of a more pressured and intense creativity, because unlike my longer stories, even the stories that were as short as 5,000 words, you have to, with 100 words, every single word counts immensely. It's like a poem. You can't have one thing out of place. And it's largely about editing rather than writing. So I'm kind of constantly tweaking and turning things around and back and forth. Like sometimes I compare 100-word story to a Rubik's cube, like you're constantly going like some, you'll edit and you'll get it down to 92 words and then you'll try to add 8 words and you'll end up adding, 22 words. And there's all this back and forth. And so the story keeps morphing as you're working with it. Its contours morph. And so, I always joke that the 100-word form is an addictive form. And it is really, like I just started writing more and more of these 100-word stories. And that led to my first collection, Fissures, which is a collection of 100 100-word stories. And then I launched 100-word Story Magazine with my friend Lynn Mundell as a result as well. And that was way, way back in 2011. The reason I say way, way back is because that seems like a very different era of flash fiction to me than the one we're experiencing now.
Right. Well, I want to ask you more about actually writing a flash fiction. But before we do that, I want to hear more about the book, The Art of Brevity, Crafting the Very Short Story, and how the book came about.
Yeah, I love writing about writing. I love writing about the creative process and just thinking about that in a bunch of different ways. I find it very nourishing to the creative process to be thinking about the creative process and actually changing my own creative process as a result. Mm-hmm. So I would just write these, these tiny little vignettes or little short pieces about writing with an aesthetic of brevity. And along the way, I published the occasional article in places like Writer's Digest or Poets and Writers or The Writer. And after a while, they just kind of all accumulated, kind of bubbled up. And I said, well, I've got enough for a book here. And so I stitched them together and wrote more and researched more and read more wonderful flash fiction stories. And it all led to The Art of Brevity. which, you know, I found to be is like one of the most satisfying things I've ever written. Because I do think that one's aesthetic, you know, sometimes I think the word aesthetic is kind of trivialized. It's just thought of as the surface beauty of something, but I think of it as more like a deep existential stance, and an aesthetic allows us to see the world through different lenses. And that's really what the book is about, is about like really thinking about your aesthetic and thinking about what different lenses, what stories, you know, you can see through them. And then how that relates to you as a writer and a storyteller.
There's so many wonderful lines in the book. One that I wrote down, let me see what I said, what you said. You said, in a short story, every sentence counts. In Flash, every word counts. What you leave out is what's important. And so, what you say in the book is, in a miniature story, this pruning is a must.
Yeah.
I was curious about that. And if you ever overwrite a story, like, will you write a story that's, you know, a few thousand words long because you've just kind of let yourself go with it. And now you're going to cut it back to under 1,000, under 600, 100 even. Will you write like that, or do you try not to write too much when you're writing short?
It's really interesting because I think like as writers, most of us are taught to write more. You know, when I mentioned earlier that the short story is like the minor leagues before you graduate to the major leagues with a novel, you know, that's usually the arc of most prose writers' lives. Very few people stay just as short story writers, even though there are some wonderful examples like Raymond Carver. But I think, like, I remember when I was getting my MFA, there was this constant, you know, the critique or the feedback would oftentimes be, I want to know more about this character. I want to know more about this scene. You know, people quest to learn more as readers, but they're forgetting that it's not the writer's job to always put more into the story, that there's that the writer's job is to evoke and to write with a sense of mystery and to invite the reader in so that the reader's using his or her imagination. And that's especially true for flash fiction, and or more true than flash fiction. Like novels require you to tell a lot. But short stories really do invite the reader in as a kind of fellow collaborator. And so that's what the art of omission really is about, is writing these short pieces really taught me about that, how to create suspense by not including everything. So in many ways, like writing 100-word stories has helped me become a better writer more than anything else I've done in life, actually, because we're rarely taught to write shorter in life or in most of the conventional classrooms. But to answer your question, let me think. So you were asking if like I might sit down to write a short and it might go 3,000, 5,000 words. It might just get longer and longer. You know, I don't think that I have like had that experience. I pretty much know when I sit down, I mean, I have an idea of the length. And that doesn't change dramatically. I mean, I'm going to say that there's one strange exception to this, and it's more about how a story evolved. And I had two characters, Gerard and Celeste, and when I put together my collection, Fissures, they were in about 20 of the stories. And readers really responded to them, and I was still very curious about them as characters. So I stitched together all those 2,000-word pieces and wrote some more and fleshed them out a little bit. And it became more of a conventional length short story, which was in my collection, All the Comfort Zinc Can Provide. But then I was still curious about them, so I actually just finished a novel about them. So that I bet that only happens once in my lifetime. But yeah, so those characters did grow from a very tiny story to now a novel that I literally just finished yesterday. Finished as in it's gone through about 13 rounds of revision. So it's not just the first draft. But I haven't experienced the other. I haven't, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I do always wonder if like a longer piece, I might end up adapting it to be really short, but I just haven't encountered that yet.
Do you think writers are either short story writers or novelists?
No, I don't. I think unfortunately, people sometimes rigidly define themselves around a form or a genre. Like some people will be like, I'm a romance author, I'm a sci-fi author. And you can combine the two, actually. I don't think we need to be so narrowly defined. And oftentimes, like if you're a published writer, your agent or editor might want you to do that for your personal brand for sales, you know. I mean, I know people who've gotten pigeonholed into genres they're not even that interested in writing in, you know. Like, I know a middle grade fiction author who didn't really set out to be a middle grade fiction author, but that's her career now. And so the same thing goes with short and long and nonfiction and fiction. I actually write in all those forms, and I think they all kind of have a conversation together. I think they all make me a better writer. They also, like, one of the benefits when I was talking about my doomed novel, taking a break and writing these short pieces really gave me creative fuel. And part of that was is that I could write something and finish it. So I had this sense of satisfaction at finishing something, which is it really fed my creative fuel. And then I could submit them and get them published. And that also, like, gave me additional creative juice. So, and that all, I brought that back to the novel, or I brought that back to other endeavors. So I'm like one now who likes to jump, you know, back and forth to different, like, forms and different pieces to work on.
What about something you might write an essay about, something from your life that, you know, feels very personal, that maybe could be an essay? Have you done that, written a short story instead, or written a flash piece instead of writing an essay? I don't even know if you write essays.
I do. Yeah, I'm writing increasingly more personal things, and essays and memoir-ish types of things. I think this is something that naturally happens to writers as we get older, more and more interested in that excavation of a life. I haven't ever had that choice of one or the other. I haven't said, okay, this isn't going to be an essay, I want to present this as a novel. Like, I think there's something about creator's intuition that guides them to the form. And I think it's something that speaks to you almost. I don't know. I don't have a grid. I don't have logic for what I write. You know, I kind of know if I want it to be a short story, a novel, an essay, or a memoir.
Before you start.
Yeah, I think before I start. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. You also said in the book, let me find it. You said the most haunting stories are those that don't provide answers but open up questions. So I'm curious, you know, it's hard enough to end a short story where you've had a couple thousand words or more to develop an idea. But with Flash, I mean, it ends. And how ambiguous an ending is okay? Like, what do you want to be left with? What do you want to leave the reader with by the end of a very short story?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. One that I love to think about, especially in the particularities of any story. Mm-hmm. I always think of the Jane Ann Phillips quote where she said that a short story, like a flash fiction story, should end in a breath. Mm-hmm. And so, and that the reader leaves with that breath. And so I think it is something as sort of gentle and mysterious as that. I once read somebody's advice. I wish I knew who this was, but they said that every story should end, or if you're in doubt about your ending of a story, in two paragraphs earlier. So that's not mathematical. Maybe it's three paragraphs, but I think it's something always interesting to look at your stories. Cause like what I find that I do with my endings often is I work really hard to nail that ending, and then working really hard to nail that ending, I oftentimes add a lot, right? That's my impulse, is to really, I don't know, I end up going further than I should. And I think as writers, we need to trust what we can evoke. And exactly that sense of mystery and ambiguity. You know, ambiguity is usually a word that's not thought of as positively, but I think it can be positive, especially with flash fiction, because flash fiction really operates with a sense of ambiguity, which is also a sense of mystery. And but it is just a judgment call. I recently had a story, as Kim Chinky asked for a story for her magazine, and I gave her this story that I've been working on for quite a while. And when I sent it to her, I had cut the very last sentence. I just wanted a little bit more mystery, a little bit more ambiguity. And then I showed it to another writer friend, and she thought I should add that sentence back in. And so Kim hadn't seen the version with the last sentence. So I went back to her and just asked her for her editorial judgment. She thought it was better without it. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know that there's a way to make that decision. It is an editorial call, a judgment call. I decided to go without the sentence because I think so often, again, like, it's like our inclination is to put in more. And I think a lot of things can operate more effectively with less. I mean, that's the whole less is more, right? That's the proof of it. So anyway, I don't know.
Well, what you made me think of is, like, we pad the ending, but we also pad beginnings, right? I mean, mm-hmm. often, you know, there's all that throat clearing stuff at the beginning of a story where you go, you know, I mean, this is actually with longer stories, but, you know, I really think it begins on page 4. It doesn't begin on page 1.
It's and true.
I would imagine with flash fiction, even more so, you just so have to begin where it's all unfolding at that moment without any padding.
Yeah, definitely. There's not much room for padding, especially if it's a 100-word story. But I think you're right. I think we as writers, sometimes we just fall in love with our writerliness, or we like to indulge in it. And in a novel, so many novels, early drafts go on way too long before things start to happen, you know, and most readers lose patience. Even if you, yeah, you know, I mean, you know, not necessarily, sometimes it's a great story when it moves. So with that kind of meandering pace, but, I think it's something to be conscious of, just like with endings. And I think it's very conscious, especially like you say, I mean, Flash, the very genre itself, the name for it, comes from a lightning bolt. You know, it is like a sudden, intense illumination coming from the sky. That literally comes, James Thomas, who named the genre, he and his wife, when they were discussing the name of the genre, there was a lightning bolt that came down from the sky, and that gave them the idea. So I'm not just making this up. But I think, I mean, in the Art of Brevity, I actually have a chapter, 13 Ways of Looking at Flash Fiction, that has way more than 13 metaphors, actually. But I think it's really interesting to think about metaphorically, because that can guide your aesthetic or your sensibility as a writer.
Before we bring Grant back on, a few words about Patreon. Patreon is a way you can help Marie and me to continue bringing the show to you. We have perks for patrons: the invitation to pose questions for upcoming guest authors and agents, prompts and writing tips. You can also help the show by buying your books at bookshop.org/shop/writersonwriting, where you'll find books by authors who've been on the show, as well as other books we like. Please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/writersonwriting. And now for more with Grant Faulkner. I like you have assignments too.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. Was that a part of the book from the start? Was that something you added later and thought, you know what, let's now put what this chapter says to work?
Yeah. Initially I was resistant to the exercises. I had this book. It was about, I don't know, maybe 25% shorter. It was very elliptical. I wanted the form of the book to match its subject. And of course, my editor agent said, no, that's not the way to go about it. I'm joking, but I think they were right. You know, I have a certain vision of my book, but it's for a very small audience. And I do think that this one works a lot better because it guides the readers more directly. And it can, you know, just having chapter topics that are very specific helped me focus on that. And then, sorry, my phone's ringing. But the exercises, you know, they came back at my agent and editors. They asked for them, and they just thought that both writers would like them, and that teachers would like them. And so this is a book also for teachers, and they were great to draw up. And I keep hearing from people that that's like one of the things they like most about the book. So I'm really happy they're in there. Again, I'm telling this story to illustrate how the writer can be wrong about their very own book, and how important it is to get that good editorial guidance. And even when you initially feel resistant to it, to think about your book taking alternative paths. So I love doing the exercises, and it helps me too, because like one wonderful thing about this book is I do a lot of workshops with it. I teach teach from it. And so it's nice to see those exercises in action in real time.
I'm curious, just in terms of publishing, if you got any pushback over writing a book about writing. You know, I mean, sometimes agents will say, oh, there's too many books about writing and we don't need another book about writing. But then all these books about writing keep coming out. And so obviously there's a hunger for them. But did your agent ever go, you know, I'm not really sure if this is going to.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, you're absolutely right. When I was growing up, there was a very small bookshelf of books about writing. There were like probably 5 kind of classic books, and not many more than that. I mean, I'm sounding like I must be 200 years old, but it really is like a contemporary modern thing that hundreds of books about writing or thousands of books about writing have been written. And I think that the challenge is, it is like a business challenge in some ways. Like, how do you stand out? How do you write something that is different than these other books? And I think that's what I did with this, actually. There aren't that many books that are focused on flash fiction. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it was, and the ones that are focused on flash fiction are different than this book, I would say. So I do think that this book fills a certain niche, both for teachers and writers. But I'll be curious about that 10 years from now as more and more flash fiction writers, you know, write their books. Yeah, I mean, it seems like we have, I mean, I actually love reading books about writing. So mm-hmm. I have a huge bookshelf, or more than one bookshelf. I never get tired of it, really. I can read any new book that comes out. So I do think that there is something very peculiar about writing that produces a lot of books about writing. I don't think that applies to opera or guitar playing or even the visual arts or even acting. You know, there are not that many books about it.
Well, sometimes isn't it true, though, that writers, we like to talk about writing. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. stop talking and start writing, you know, because, you know, if you're going to talk so much, you know, especially talking out ideas. I was thinking about your mother who was on the phone when you were writing this story and you wanted to tell her about it, and instead you went and wrote it. Now, if you had told her, would you have dispelled all that energy for the story? And would it have gone away? You know, I mean, it's just...
That's one of those ultimate questions about writing. You know, like Hemingway always said that he never talked about his stories. He didn't want to talk them out for that very reason, that once you express them, you don't have the urgency to write them. But then there are those people I've encountered who they love talking about their stories with people, and they almost like kind of are just natural collaborators. You know, they'll tell six strangers their idea for a novel at dinner and then come back home really excited to write it because those strangers had whatever, certain responses or ideas.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I also want to talk to you about your story in flash fiction, 73 very short stories. There's some wonderful stories in here. And your story, 23 Men, I so liked as well, and was so curious how it came about.
How did that come about?
How many words is it, too? How many words?
So I don't know how many words it is, but it's probably... It's up towards that 1,000-word mark. So it's not like it's not microfiction. So it's one of my more expansive flash fiction stories. And I do remember how it came about. It was one of those, again, it seems like a lot of things happen with random internet encounters. And somehow I'd read this little thing in the Paris Review online that profiled or mentioned this photographer. And I think she was from Denmark. I could easily Google her name and find her, but she had kind of contrived all these intimate photographs kind of through dating apps. She would meet men and women, and they would kind of act out these erotic scenes, and they would be photographed. And so she was kind of doing this exploration of intimacy in different ways. And yeah, I guess somehow that just gave me this idea of this woman who's new to the city and young and exploring her own, you know, sexuality and sense of the erotic and having adventures in the city and doing kind of bold, crazy things, I guess, and maybe being a little bit out of control, but also just being strong and bold and independent in a different way. So, and more than that, I'm not explaining the whole story because I hate explaining stories. But that's where it came from. Yeah. So sometimes a story, I mean, sometimes they're more, I guess, personally anchored, and sometimes they're more like that. That's totally about something that just is random and external.
And it's written in first person. So mm-hmm. the narrator is female.
Yeah.
Did you worry about that? Like writing from the point of view of a woman?
Now, why should I worry about that?
I don't know. Everybody, I mean, there's such this focus these days, like, well, if you're not a man, you can't write from the point of view of a man. If you're not a woman, should you write from, if you're not this race, this nationality, why are you doing that? I mean, I think writers should write from whatever point of view and from whatever gender they wish. But there are some people who say, no, you shouldn't do that.
Yeah. I think as writers, you know, we have to, the premise of being a writer is to, use our imagination in nearly every way possible, or maybe every way possible. And so I think when you write something in the first person, it puts an extra challenge on you. as the author, you know, because you have to be very sensitive to doing it right, you know, and that's a wonderful thing about being a writer, right? Is that I could totally botch that. I could embarrass myself. I could make the character somehow offensive. I guess all those are risks. But that's why I think we have to be, you know, kind of respect that pressure that's put on us and be very sensitive and very careful and very thoughtful about that presentation when it's somebody different than us.
Yeah. And I think last year, maybe 2 years ago, I did a panel on appropriation versus appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the consensus was, whatever you do, just do it well. You
right.
know, instead of limiting yourself to,
well,
you know, your personal experience, your personal everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to use our imagination and really get into other characters' skins and see through their eyes. And that's, you know, we can't always do that entirely or entirely correctly, I guess, but we can do our best. And we have to do that as authors because we're not always writing about ourselves, right?
Right.
I mean, we're extrapolating from ourselves, but, you know, we want to have a lot of different and interesting characters in our stories.
So without giving the ending away of this short story, do you remember how you found your way to the ending and when you knew you had it? Because it feels like it ends the story perfectly.
No, well, I'll take that. no, I had a hard time with that ending. Mm-hmm. It was one of those endings where, as I mentioned earlier, I was, you know, adding paragraphs, adding images, whatever. I remember going through a lot of different pathways for it and thinking that almost none of them worked. And I think, you know, endings are usually like that for me, especially in the short form. You know, the endings matter so much more in short stories. I think in a novel, you can kind of just drift off and end it in a certain whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be as focused as intense, but the shorter the story, the more the ending matters. So
yeah. True. I wonder why that is. Why do you think endings matter more in short stories? I mean, because I've, you know, with novels, what's been said, like, if you get somebody reading, you know, the ending, how important is the ending? The beginning is more important. And yet I've read read novels where the ending just did not land. And then I didn't want to read anything else by the writer.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there's been endings too that fell, and I do. So, you know, I should toss that whole comment out, but,
mm-hmm.
But why do you think?
I don't know. It's because we spend less time with a short, you know? So the ending is just like, it's a bigger part of the real estate of the story, I guess. You know, like if you read a 300 page novel, you know, most of the onus of that novel to be successful is on the first 298 pages, you know, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, I mean, I have, you know, and I think what we carry with us from a novel, like we really forget most of it. You know, we'll remember certain scenes and certain characters perhaps. But I think the whole chronology of it, sometimes we don't remember them. So yeah, I just think they operate a little bit differently in our mind. I'm thinking about, I have one, I almost call it a favorite novel. It's The Savage Detectives by Roberto Bolaño. And a lot of people have the same experience that I did, that they'll read the first third or half of it and they'll just be absolutely in love with it. They'll love him as an author. And then there's this intense slog in the middle. And I've never finished it. I've tried twice, but it remains like one of my favorite novels for the first half. So anyway, someday I'll finish it, maybe.
Maybe he needed, you know, there's so much emphasis now on midpoint and the muddled middle, you know, and maybe had someone talk to him about, you know, you need a tentpole here. You need to like lift up the middle of your book. Maybe it would have turned out differently.
Maybe. I mean, I think he was just a highly experimental author who wrote for himself. And sometimes when you're like that, you're not satisfying the reader in ways they might want to be satisfied. So, you know, so I'm willing to forgive him for that because that first half was so great.
Well, what about dialogue in flash? Because I notice there's very little typically. The dialogue can, you know, I mean, in novels, of course, it can go on and on. And even then, it sometimes is too much. But what about dialogue? I mean, Yeah, will you talk about dialogue in Flash?
Yeah, I mean, I think some stories, I mean, I think one of the things I like about Flash are stories that are told entirely in dialogue. I have one of those stories at least. I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting observation you have. I'm just kind of wondering if it's true. I mean, I have that sense, I guess, with my writing as well. I think maybe it's just that you're not presenting whole scenes where people might sit down and have a conversation. I think, like, since you're presenting such a kind of fragment of a life or a story anyway, like the dialogue tends to be a little less important, a little more fragmentary. But I think you can do a lot with dialogue in a Flash story. Like I said, I mean, oftentimes when I teach it, I do the he said, she said, they said story, you know, where people are just going back and forth with dialogue, and through the words and the way they speak, you're characterizing them and presenting a conflict.
And then there's summary. It seems summary works okay in Flash. Is that true? Or is it just the story's finding, you know?
Yeah, you know, I never like think about things that work or don't work or writer rules. I mean, I don't think about show, don't tell. I just think about what works for the writer in a particular story, you know, and I think anything can work. Even that horrible middle that Roberto Bolaño wrote somehow can work, you know. So I think it's just our job to write as writers to think about what is dramatically necessary and making it work. So I think sometimes, yeah, I mean, summary, sure. Sometimes that's required, right? In any kind of form.
Who have been your influences? Who do you read when you need a jump start with writing?
That's a good question. I like to read, like I read poetry. I try to always have a poetry book, and not necessarily a particular poet, although sometimes I'll get kind of obsessed with a poet. And the reason I do that is because I mean, it's really good for Flash because I think of Flash as my form of poetry as a prose writer. And it can just make me pay more attention and a different kind of attention to the world. I like reading, you know, I mean, Lydia Davis is a wonderful influence for Flash fiction. I like reading James Salter, who's a very writerly writer. I mean, he has great short stories and great novels. Yeah, I mean, I like so many different kinds of writing. You know, some of my favorite novelists are Paul Bowles' Sheltering Sky and Malcolm Lowry's Under the Volcano. I love, oh my gosh, I'm spacing on the name. Ocean Vuong, his work. I always forget the name of the novel on This Life Were Briefly Gorgeous. I've been really into Sigrid Nunez lately. I think she, because she has a really interesting minimalist style, you know, and very, it's I guess the term is like these days we're talking about autofiction, and that includes Rachel Cusk, who I like a lot as well, you know. I mean, they're just really deep, thoughtful people and deep, thoughtful writers who write with a very interesting, intimate style, you know. And the novel that I mentioned that I just finished is an epistolary novel, a novel written in letters. And I think when I read Rachel Cusk, or especially Sigrid Nunez, I almost feel like she has that kind of intimacy where she's almost, her novels are kind of like a letter.
Have you ever read 84 Charing Cross Road by Helen Hanf? It's a really thin novel that is epistolary, and it's between a writer in New York. And Helen Hanf wrote for radio and TV back in the, 50s, 40s. No, probably 40s, because she starts this correspondence with a bookseller in London, this fictional bookseller in London. And the war is starting up. So it's sort of the story of, London, New York, the war, these books that go back and forth, this relationship. But it's such a wonderful story.
Sounds
Very
great.
short novel, very short novel. You could read it in a day.
I love everything you described it by, so I'll check it out.
I think you would love it. Well, what's the biggest, and this is a question that came in from a listener. What's the biggest or most common mistake you encounter in flash fiction?
Well, with 100-word stories, and this comes from reading thousands of submissions, I think it's easy to think you're done with a story before it's done. And that's because you can write a 100-word story so quickly. And so sometimes it seems like it's definitely a first or second draft. And I like to quote one of my writing professors, Molly Giles, who's a great flash fiction writer as well. And she said, they can take 3 days to write, or really even 3 minutes sometimes, but they take 3 years to finish. And I think writers need to keep that in mind, that the amount of intense attention and revision is really necessary for these short pieces, I think, in ways that longer pieces sometimes don't require.
Well, you're reminding me of that quote that I think is attributed to Mark Twain, something like, I would have written a shorter letter, but I didn't have the time.
Right. It's a great quote.
Yeah. Isn't that a great quote? I don't know if he said it or who said it, but
it's attributed to him most commonly. Yeah. But I think it's like one of those things. No one's sure.
No one's sure. But I love that because, the shorter you go, the more refined the work has to be.
Exactly.
Whatever it is, right?
Yeah, you have to be more thoughtful about what you're putting in there and why.
There's another question that came in when one of our listeners knew I was going to be talking to you. And it had to do with, and you sort of talked about this, how flash has affected your other writing. Mm-hmm. But maybe if you could say a little bit more about that, like writing a novel, how mm-hmm. has flash fiction influenced that? How you write scenes or what you keep?
Yeah, I think definitely in the sense of that being able to be better at creating suspense and writing toward the mystery, like flash has really taught me that art of omission and how including less can be more. I also think my sensibility has really just shifted. I don't, like so many of my earlier novels followed a more kind of conventional trajectory, that I was kind of doing the whole roller coaster, plot, the stakes are going up, throughout the novel. And I never was comfortable writing with that plot framework. I'm not a plotter in that way. And so flash fiction has given me, I on my podcast, I interviewed Lydia Yuknovich, and we were both kind of bonding over the fact that we were not plotters and we were trying to find different ways to think about stories. And we both had read Natalie Serreau. She's another writer I read for inspiration, and how Natalie Serreau, as Lydia put it, wrote to the intensities. And that's what I do with my novels. I write to the intensities rather than just writing with that kind of plot framework, that conventional plot framework. And then I think also my feeling for life is that it's just more fragmentary and elliptical. And the way that our memories work, it's mm-hmm. really this kind of patchwork or collage of snapshots and scenes. And so I write more with that kind of form and aesthetic in mind. That was part of the book too, is just kind of articulating why I think that's a good way to tell a story and how that can work on the page. So I like to use white space. I just like to capture the subtleties of a story and the nuances and those really quiet, intimate moments of life.
Well, speaking of white space, this book is so pleasant in that way. I mean, there's a lot of white space. You don't feel like the pages are just, stuffed with words.
Mm-hmm. Which, oh, good.
I don't know why, some books are so where the page, it's hard to get down the page. It's like there's too many words, but it's a nice aesthetic to it.
Thank you. We've been using.
And you teach. And so I'm curious how teaching influences your writing.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think kind of like being an editor as well is just, I'm always pleasantly surprised by the creative approaches people take towards stories, And so it keeps me fresh in terms of my own thinking about how I tell stories. And then I think just being in dialogue with others, teaching is another form of community. Hearing other people's reaction and feedback, or even just like now, your comments about the book, it's just always keeps me a little bit sharper, and refreshed to be with others and talking about writing.
Well, we are getting to the end of the show, and I wonder if you have any tips or writing advice for the writers listening, especially those who are working on flash fiction.
Yeah, my best advice for writers is I feel like everybody needs to do a lot of introspection and reflection, and to nurture a belief in themselves as writers. I think that becoming successful at writing, actually, and success broadly, whether you want to be published or not, it is about believing in your story, and if you think about it, if you don't believe in your story, you won't even write the first words of that story. And if you don't believe in your story, you won't go through the hard work of revision or the hard work of drafting. And if you don't believe your story, you won't send it out to people. You won't share it, and if it gets published, if you don't believe in it, you can still not believe in your story once it's published, by the way. You won't have the same energy towards promoting it and making it successful in the world. So I just keep thinking about how it's not something that a book can really teach you, or that maybe you can be taught anywhere, but I think it's just something we all need to keep thinking about is like, am I committing to this? And if I'm not committing to this, why? And so I think like just, and that's where like having a good nourishing community of writers can really help you, to keep, because it's like, we can have good days where we believe in ourselves and then the next day is a bad day. So it's kind of a constant thing we have to work on, but I think it's really necessary to write boldly too. To write your truth. And that's what we all want to do. That's why we got into this, right? To write our truth, to express ourselves. So, I think that that's like the first step is believing in yourself.
How do you deal with rejection?
I get better and better at it as time goes on, for the most part. I'll tell this story. Nathan Englander had dinner with Philip Roth at the later stages of Philip Roth's career, when you'd think that Philip Roth would be generous fellow. And Nathan Englander asked him, does it get better? Does your skin thicken as you go through this more and with each book? And Philip Roth was like, no, your skin gets thinner and thinner and thinner. But Philip Roth was a very spiteful man, and he would carry his grudges, throughout his lifetime. Like he basically died complaining that he'd never been awarded the Nobel Prize. And so, so this is all to say that I think as writers, like you don't want to end up like Philip Roth, because rejection can be a really good experience. And most of the time that I've been rejected, it's helped me. Once I'm over the pain of it, and I'm not trying to minimize the pain at all, but it helps me think about the work in a new way and helps me make it better. And it's coincidental that you're asking that, because I just finished a nonfiction proposal to write a book on rejection, and that's going out on submission as we speak. So I'm hoping that I'll come back in a couple of years and we can talk about rejection.
Be
Because
great.
I do think it is the most, one of the most, I mean, who we are as writers is determined by how we handle rejection.
That's a great note to end on. I'll look forward to that book too, and your novel. And
Yeah.
yeah, and I so appreciate you taking the time, Grant. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. This was really fun. Thanks for your great questions.
That was Grant Faulkner. Thanks to all of you for taking the time to listen, and a huge thanks to our Patreon supporters who help make this show possible. I have a Substack page called Pen on Fire where I talk about writing and include more from authors and agents who've been on the show. Thanks to Travis Barrett, who does our music and sound editing. If you like the music you hear on the show, you can find an album's worth of typewriter music on Spotify. Search out the artist Just My Type. Travis also has other music on there under his name. You can access our archive of shows, thousands by now, at writersonwriting.com. If you want to get in touch with us, email writersonwritingpodcast@gmail.com, and you can reach Travis Barrett at travisbarrettcreative@gmail.com. Thank you for listening, and in the meantime, remember to stay in the chair.